From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The whole world will be listening tomorrow when President Barack Obama takes the podium to announce reforms at the NSA. How deep, how real will they be? This hour on Point, the president's options and reforming the NSA. But first today, a quick check-in on news of emerging scandal in the U.S. Air Force Officer Corps responsible for launching U.S. nuclear missiles. First drugs, now cheating on readiness exams. Phil Stewart, Pentagon reporter for Reuters, joins us from Washington. Phil, thank you very much for being with us.
No, thanks, Tom.
34 Air Force officers suspended, security clearances revoked, and for what, Phil?
Well, what happened was a missile launch officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base, which is in Montana, apparently sent a text message with answers to a proficiency test to 16 other officers. And then during the investigation, they found out another 17 officers admitted they at least knew the material had been shared. So this is the biggest incident of its kind in memory for the nuclear missile force.
So this is partly about cheating on the exam, partly about the honor code. If you know someone is cheating, you're supposed to reveal that, and they did not. What kind of exam was this? What's it for, Phil?
This is a proficiency test. So it's about everything that an officer would need to know to kind of operate the nuclear missiles.
So these are the officers who are actually at the missile sites, in the silos or next to them, down on the ground or over, ready to launch.
That's right.
Is it technically challenging to launch these missiles? Is that why? I'm reading they have very regular exams here. I mean, good thing, but is it very complicated?
Well, there are a series of tests that go on. It's not just this one test. And the reason is that it can be very complicated, and they actually can't ever practice really launching missiles. They can just do simulations for obvious reasons. So there are limitations to what these tests can accomplish, and that's why there's so many of them.
This is 34 officers suspended out of 190 missile officers there just at Malmstrom.
Yep.
Second lieutenants through captains, I'm reading here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the first whiff of scandal around this officer corps. There have been drug apprehensions in the Air Force that have reached into this group as well.
Yeah, that's true. The 11 Air Force officers now we know, including two from the Malmstrom cheating scandal, have also been the focus of another investigation. The investigation actually that led to the disclosure of this cheating scandal.
Does that mean we have stoned officers in the silos with their fingers on the trigger?
Well, I don't think they know. They're not talking quite a whole lot about the drug scandal yet, so we don't know the extent of it. But you would hope not.
What's the atmosphere that's contributing to this? I mean, we're reading about low morale in this group of officers as the sort of nuclear ready stance has become less important. It's become kind of a backwater. What's going on?
Well, you know, yesterday at the Pentagon news briefing where the Air Force disclosed all this, General Mark Welsh, who's the chief of staff of the Air Force, spoke a bit about the need to kind of keep a sense of urgency in the mission. And I think that there's a sense that since the end of the Cold War, the kind of the glamour of this mission has faded a bit. And the missileers, that's what they're called, have kind of seen their jobs as being, you know, less important than other parts of the U.S. military mission, and especially after, you know, more than a decade of war.
We've had Chuck Hagel, Defense Secretary, out at missile sites trying to buck them up, I guess. Also, a top commander here, Major General Michael Carey, who was removed. This is of the 20th Air Force. They're the ones who maintain and operate intercontinental ballistic missiles after he was on a kind of a bender in Moscow, and he was in charge.
Yeah, that is an amazing, amazing eye-popping story that broke last year and late last year. He was fired in October for getting drunk and carousing with women while leading a government delegation to Moscow for talks on nuclear security. And it's just a shocking story. I mean, Kerry was said at one point to be slurring his words on a trip to a local monastery, and he asked repeatedly a chance to sing with a Beatles cover band at a Mexican restaurant. This is all came out from an investigation by the Inspector General of the Air Force.
And this is the commander in charge of intercontinental ballistic missiles. What's the Pentagon saying in the wake of all this at this point, Phil Stewart? What's the plan for getting this core? I mean, whether nukes are front and center or not, the destructive power is the same. You can't have this being kind of a loose operation.
That's absolutely right. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, the Pentagon put out a statement last night saying he was particularly concerned about this, that, you know, he takes this mission has to be a top priority. But you know, there needs to be a better sense. The Air Force has to show, I guess, at this point, that it has a grasp on where the limits of this problem of discipline and morale really are. And I think that's part of the reason that they're retesting the entire nuclear missile force. Those tests should be completed by the end of Thursday. And, you know, they say they're going to share the results of those tests, but also they're going to have to look at procedures and protocols, especially regarding these simulations, which, as I said before, you know, they can't actually launch a nuclear missile and see how it goes. They've got to do these things in simulation. That's why these tests are so important. And the fact that people are cheating on them, well, that speaks volumes.
Watch this space. A hint of disarray around America's nuclear missile arsenal. Very unsettling. Phil Stewart covers the Pentagon for Reuters News Service. Phil, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now to the NSA. Tomorrow morning, the president will lay out for the country and the world his plans to reform and maybe rein in the National Security Agency, the country's super high-tech and lately embattled electronic surveillance spy service. Do you expect big changes? What do you want to hear tomorrow from the president on NSA spying and privacy rights? Do you want big changes, or have you made your peace with a post-privacy world? In a moment, we'll be joined by Stephen Levy of Wired Magazine, who's written a big story on this. But I want to turn first to Siobhan Gorman in Washington, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covers terrorism, counterterrorism in this country's 16 intelligence agencies. Siobhan Gorman, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here. What's the president expected to lay down tomorrow?
Well, I think in terms of changes, we're probably going to see more as it has to do with NSA's foreign spying than it does kind of the intersection with domestic privacy concerns. So far, in speaking with administration officials who keep cautioning, well, you know, anything could change up until the moment the president gives his speech, it sounds like they're looking to try to make some changes in terms of providing more privacy protections for just sort of average citizens around the world, not just U.S. citizens. They have been continuously reviewing how they factor in diplomatic sensitivities into sensitive spying operations, say, that will, target foreign leaders and things like that. We're expecting less change at this point when it comes to the now infamous NSA phone data collection program, which collects the phone records of nearly all Americans or all U.S. phone calls. At this point, it looks like Mr. Obama may sort of make some adjustments in terms of how NSA handles that program internally, but is largely going to leave it to Congress to decide whether or not that program needs to be restructured.
Does the White House appear to have any enthusiasm for reforming the NSA?
Well, I think that they have vacillated. I think that there's been a lot of conflicting views within the administration, which is why we're kind of seeing a split the baby approach when it comes to NSA reform. I think there are a lot of really competing demands, whether it has to do with, you know, civil liberties issues, national security imperatives. I think that there are a lot of tensions there, and they've been really struggling to resolve those.
The president had a panel put together that came to him with recommendations, several dozen, 40-plus recommendations. If you put what he's likely to propose with those recommendations side by side, who's more aggressive?
Well, in terms of suggesting more change, certainly the review panel would be more aggressive. They were recommending things like, a full-scale restructuring of this phone data program that would have either the phone companies or a third party hold on to the data and would require NSA to get a judicial order for each search of those phone records, which would have been a pretty significant change to that program. They also would have effectively neutered national security letters by requiring that they have a judicial sign-off, because right now the tool is sort of the main function of the tool is to allow NSA to, or sorry, to allow the FBI to get data without having to go through a judicial review. So there are the review group definitely was recommending a lot more changes that would have incorporated judicial oversight into the process.
Does the White House have the last word on this, or could this go? There are moves in Congress as well, Siobhan.
Well, I don't think the White House will have the last word on this, particularly as it has to do with the phone program, because we've already got legislation on Capitol Hill. There's bipartisan legislation that would restructure the program in similar ways to what the review group suggested, and that debate will continue. And that debate could go on for another year and a half or so, because the law that is sort of used to authorize that phone program is up for reauthorization in summer of 2015, and so that may well become the final forcing function, because if the the administration and NSA want to continue to use that program, there may be some negotiations around at least that potential expiration of the law.
Barack Obama was very critical of this kind of surveillance before he was president of the United States. Does he seem to have changed his mind with the commander-in-chief responsibility that he holds now, Siobhan?
Well, there definitely seems to have been an evolution in his thinking, although we saw some early indications of sympathies for the need to, give NSA some pretty extensive surveillance powers, even as far back as 2008, when the Senate was debating the surveillance law reforms, which Senator Barack Obama supported.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about reforming the NSA as the president prepares to lay out his plans. In his end-of-the-year press conference at the White House in December, President Obama said he was confident the NSA was not abusing its incredible spying capabilities to snoop on Americans, but he said the potential for abuse is there, better safeguards are needed.
I have confidence in the fact that the NSA is not engaging in domestic surveillance or snooping around, but I also recognize that as technologies change and people can start running algorithms and programs that map out all the information that we're downloading on a daily basis into our telephones and our computers, that we may have to refine this further to give people more confidence.
More confidence. People haven't really found it yet. Just this week on Tuesday, before the Senate Judiciary Committee, former CIA Deputy Director Michael Morell said the U.S. government's initial response to the big leaks by whistleblower Edward Snowden had failed to convince Americans and people abroad that the NSA would be reined in.
The strategy that was being pursued was not successful, clearly not successful. The strategy that was pursued did not mitigate the lack of public trust, did not win back any of the public trust.
It's not there. Congresspeople, senators as well, Republican Mike Lee of Utah said on Tuesday he worries that the information the NSA is collecting will sooner or later be misused.
We've seen this movie before. We know how it ends. We know that eventually, if that much information remains in the hands of government for that long, it will eventually be abused.
There's concern in civil liberties quarters. Of course, there's concern about national security. The president wants information on that front. There is also concern in commercial quarters in this country, Silicon Valley in particular, which has seen its own credibility really hit in the Edward Snowden revelations. Siobhan Gorman, stand by in Washington for just a moment. Stephen Levy joins us now from New York, senior staff writer for Wired. His big story last week was titled How the NSA Almost Killed the Internet. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen Levy, welcome back to On Point. You've got Silicon Valley up in arms here over what we've seen from the NSA. What's the problem for them, and what are they hoping for tomorrow?
Well, they have a number of problems there, and the first is just the way the very first revelations tied them to this information gathering came on the heels of the phone metadata program you mentioned, and people immediately assumed that all the information they had in their servers, which is an enormous amount of information about us, for what we search for and what we share with others, our mail, was going directly to the NSA. And they tried to tamp that down and talk about the limits of the programs that were exposed, which essentially forces them to provide certain information when the government asks for it, sometimes without warrants. And then we learned another leak, Snowden leak, that the government was actually taking massive amounts of stuff that the companies didn't hand over to them by essentially tapping their operations overseas. Specifically in one program, they just grabbed all the traffic between the data centers at Google and Yahoo, which is could be pretty much everything there. So they don't want to be seen as a direct conduit to the U.S. spying operation. Not only do domestic customers have worries about that, but especially international customers. And President Obama didn't do the companies a favor when, you know, right after the first announcement, he said, don't worry, we're only spying on foreign people. You know, we're not spying on United States people. Well, over half the business of these companies is overseas, so that really didn't do much for them.
So we've got our Constitution on the line, Fourth Amendment, search and seizure. We've got our high-tech economy. I mean, your headline was tech titans fighting for their lives in this contest. And then there's national security, which the NSA is very quick to raise, president as well in the White House. All right, Siobhan and Stephen, people are going to be listening tomorrow, and I'd like to just go through with a little bit of a fine-tooth comb here what people ought to be listening for in terms of whether there is real reform on the most controversial portions of the NSA's work here or not. And Stephen, let me come first to you on that. If you're a Silicon Valley master of the universe, and you're afraid that your global reputation and business are in trouble, we'll come to civil liberties. I mean, they're first for Americans, but this matters too. Was there something in the review panel's recommendations that would have given Silicon Valley comfort? Is it likely to be in the president's speech tomorrow? What will you be listening for, Stephen?
Well, there's a few things that companies are focusing on, and a couple of them I think they're likely to get. One is that they want the ability to be more transparent about the information that they do provide. Right now, a number of things that they do, they can't talk about. They're classified there. They can't break out how many customers are involved in some of these operations. They have to hand over information. So I think they're going to get some transparency, flexibility that they don't have before.
Could you hold that one for a second? Siobhan Gorman, do you expect the president to say, Silicon Valley, we're going to take the muzzle off and let you talk about exactly what you do and do not provide the NSA?
I think that they've definitely been sympathetic to the idea of allowing companies and other entities that are involved in this these programs to be a little bit more open. And the challenge that the government has had is trying to decide where to draw the line, what's okay to reveal that's not going to be detrimental to national security, and what is going to raise national security concerns. So it'll be interesting to see sort of where they draw that line.
Stephen Levy, how much transparency does Silicon Valley need to keep from fighting for its life in this NSA embrace?
Well, I think that it really is, you know, something on the edges there. I don't think it's really going to do very much. They do these transparency reports now, and they don't really have much impact on the way people perceive the problem there. I think one of the bigger things, Siobhan mentioned it earlier, and I'm really curious to see how far the president would go along this lines of giving privacy rights to overseas citizens. From my understanding of the NSA, this is, you know, really their bread and butter. Is, you know, they feel that they have, you know, the legal authority and the freedom to pretty much listen in on people who are not U.S. persons. And if that's restricted in some ways, I'd be curious to know how far that goes there. And, you know, because I from my understanding, it would really have to change the way the NSA operates.
Siobhan Gorman, okay, on this front, we have the sense of the NSA maybe having some, you know, little window dressing of a speed bump for American citizens, but really nothing abroad, that they can just vacuum up anything on anybody, anywhere practically. What about privacy of foreigners?
Well, historically, that's not been a concern for NSA, because what NSA is focused on is making sure that they follow U.S. law. Now, that obviously isn't going to apply overseas. So,
meaning no holds barred.
Right. I mean, it's you know, you have free range over the rest of the world.
But here you've got American international companies whose very businesses – not to mention just global trust and USA and its principles, hinges on some sense that there's some respect for foreign people.
Well, yes. And what I think the administration, NSA, sort of didn't fully appreciate as the story became a much more global one, was that their audience here really is international. Historically, NSA has, worked to varying degrees of success to try to show that it wasn't engaging in domestic spying. And obviously, that's a whole separate debate we're having. But on the foreign side, it just hasn't felt like it needs to make the case, because that is its mandate, to spy on, foreign intelligence interests overseas, and that is something that is defined quite broadly. But Stephen is certainly right. I mean, the technology companies, and this is broadly, I mean, this is technology, telecommunications companies in the U.S. at this point are really up in arms, because they feel like this is doing damage to overseas deals. I mean, we've seen it threatening deals that AT&T is trying to forge overseas, and so these guys are definitely feeling like they are bearing a huge price for all of these revelations.
It doesn't sound like a lot of enthusiasm here, Stephen. Is there a bone that could be thrown to this issue that would be enough for these companies to stand in good stead abroad? Or do we just have a gap between White House national security interest perspective and theirs?
Well, there were like a few other things. I guess one other thing, and I think, folks are fairly pessimistic about this, that the Silicon Valley companies are in support of the kinds of legislation, some of the more aggressive forms of legislation that would really limit bulk collection there. Now, the review panel was interesting on this. They basically said that the NSA should avoid bulk collection of data unless it's really, really, really necessary there. And I think when you talk to the NSA, they are very concerned about staying on the right side of the law, but they're very aggressive at interpreting the law. And if the law gives them some flexibility, they feel to protect the nation, they have to go to the limits of that.
But what does unless necessary mean? I mean, you're either doing bulk collection or you're not.
I looked at those words jumped out of the page to me. I don't know what Siobhan thought, but I thought, that's interesting. I think when you get down to this, it's really difficult to set down the laws, as we found, and come up with a degree of collection and surveillance that we think we know what we have. Some people in Congress say, gee, I don't think I authorized that, especially when they heard about all the massive metadata collection there. And what I'm really hoping for from the president personally is that not only is he going to say what he's going to do, but he uses this as one of the few times in his presidency where he wraps around an issue and really lays it out for us. This is like a classic major conflict we have between privacy and security there. And some people feel, it could be solved and it's a false conflict. But really, there are a lot of questions about how far we go to protect ourselves and at what point do we give up the things that make us unique as a nation and really, the things that we send people overseas to fight for, right? So I would like to see the president really grapple with this issue and put it in perspective for us. So then when he announces what reforms he does and doesn't do, we'll get a sense of where that fits in on this large.
I'm not sure rhetoric can solve this one. I mean, I know what
as a run-up to the reforms, I think that, I would like to see a framework here that, that people can live with. One of the problems we've had, and the reason why this is so shocking to people, is that it has, gone on in stealth and, people yearn for more transparency here, and I think that it wouldn't solve the problem, but we wouldn't have been so shocked by the Snowden revelations had we known the extent to which the government was collecting the information.
Siobhan, let's go to this issue of bulk phone data, metadata. The proposal put out there, I believe, from the review panel is take that out of the hands of the NSA, that data, put it back in private hands, commercial hands, and then force them to go in with specific requests for information rather than just have the river constantly running through their own institution. I'm reading the president is not likely even to make that step to move the data out of their hands. What are you hearing, Siobhan?
That's consistent with what we've been hearing. Our sense at this point is that this is something that the president has struggled with a lot and is, coming to the conclusion that, this probably needs further debate and discussion. And so this is going to be something for Congress to wrestle with now. And so obviously the White House would continue to be engaged in that discussion. But I don't think we're going to see something really clear on that. And that is an issue that certainly civil libertarians and privacy advocates are very, very focused on, as well as obviously lawmakers and others.
A tough, tough challenge for the president here. And I'm not hearing a lot of confidence he's going to take very substantial steps. Robert in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Robert, thank you for calling. What are you looking for?
Say, I am very disappointed with the commercial entities involved here, that so many of them have just completely rolled over and supplied the government instead of taking a higher level challenge, maybe up to the Supreme Court. They've just given over everything that's been asked for by the government. I think there were many steps already before this point to question the legitimacy of that kind of a request. I think that about sums it up.
Yeah.
There were many steps before this that we could have taken.
Robert, I appreciate your call. Let me take it to Stephen. Stephen, that's right in your wheelhouse. Did they just roll over? Google, Facebook, and all the rest? Robert would like to see them out of Oklahoma City fight this right to the Supreme Court. Were they even in a position to do that, given that they, as you said, by law, there's a lot they couldn't even discuss here?
Well, the telecoms, I think, pretty much did roll over. They don't appear to have challenged it in the constitutionality of this massive collection of data about American citizens in court there. The internet companies, it varies. Yahoo, as we've learned this year when we had some documents declassified, did challenge the program, the PRISM program, where they had to provide the information in the FISA secret court there. And they haven't won those challenges. And some of this, some of these challenges are still pending. None of them have gone to the Supreme Court. And I think some of the other companies were watching very carefully what happened with their with that Yahoo challenge, and which Yahoo didn't win, and the companies had to hand that over. But I think there's a point to say maybe they could have done more. And it's interesting. I talked to one person who has been in the very highest reaches of one of the big companies there. And he was telling me that these companies are conflicted. On one hand, they want to protect their customers' privacy. On the other hand, they have their own issues with government. They don't want to be so aggressive in fighting the government that the government turns against them because they have their own regulatory worries about the government, about privacy and about antitrust. And some of them have contracts with the government. So this person told me, really, do you want to be responsible for losing a $400 million contract on this?
But you're also describing a situation where we not only have the Fourth Amendment and American civil liberties on the line here, but they have global business on the line here that it could fall apart. We go from the internet to the splinter net you're talking about people describing here.
Right, yeah. And I think, when you talk about the title of my story, that's one thing. When I talked to Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, the CEO of Facebook, about this, he told me the thing he worried most about was this issue of splinter nets, or some people call it the balkanization of the internet. Some countries are so mad at this NSA surveillance and information collection that they are moving along on a plan that had sort of been, you've heard a little bit about it before, more as a protectionist thing. But now they're saying it's because of the NSA, that they would say that we don't want the data on our citizens to move beyond our border. It has to be stored within our borders and servers there. And that would really destroy the internet as we know it, which is a borderless open system there. Companies like Facebook might be able to deal with it, but brand new startups could never launch globally if this were put into effect.
Stephen Levy with Wired Magazine, please stand by. Siobhan Gorman with The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about reforming the NSA, what we may and may not hear from the president tomorrow, fundamental rights on the line here, the Constitution. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about reforming the NSA as the president prepares to lay out his plans in a speech tomorrow. Siobhan Gorman of the Wall Street Journal is with us, covers terrorism, counterterrorism, intelligence for the Journal. Stephen Levy is here, senior staff writer for Wired. His big story last week, how the NSA almost killed the Internet. That is unresolved as we speak. We'll hear from the president tomorrow. Here he was again in December.
I think part of what's been interesting about this whole exercise is recognizing that in a virtual world, some of these boundaries don't matter anymore. And just because we can do something doesn't mean we necessarily should. And the values that we've got as Americans are ones that we have to be willing to apply beyond our borders, I think, perhaps more systematically than we've done in the past.
A lot of people will be listening tomorrow to see if there's any meat put on those bones. Cade in Boston is calling. Hi, Cade. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me. First, I just want to correct a mistake that one of your guests made. In fact, the U.S. does have an obligation to protect everyone in the world's privacy rights under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which the government is a signatory.
Okay.
But having said that, you know, this program, the Dragnet phone surveillance program, does not keep us safe. It has not stopped one terrorist attack, contrary to, you know, the lies, frankly, that the administration and the top spies keep telling the public. Even the president's NSA review group said that it hadn't stopped any terrorist attacks. So it's just flatly not true that this protects us. That's the first thing. The second thing is that President Obama, in a story published by the New York Times today, reportedly said that he trusts himself to properly oversee these Bush administration dragnet surveillance programs. But does President Obama think that he's going to be the president forever? You know, we saw with Chris Christie's bridge scandal that some people who could potentially be the president in a few years maybe will not have the same sort of respect that President Obama thinks he has for Americans' privacy rights. And these programs are not going to go away when President Obama leaves office. And, you know, that said, I would just say that no matter what he says tomorrow, it's really going to be up to us and to Congress and possibly the courts to rein in this completely out-of-control surveillance state. And, you know, the first step in that process is going to be passing the USA Freedom Act. So to anyone who's listening, I would say please call your representatives and tell them to support that bill, which, among other critical things, will end this dragnet phone records program.
Kid, I appreciate your call. I mean, the U.S. Constitution is supposed to be bulwark number one in this effort. Of course, big questions about what's compliant there and what's not. You say the metadata hasn't worked. Interestingly, Siobhan, I want to bring this to you, but this week, this is Michael Morell, Deputy Director of CIA, before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Tuesday, saying that the 215 program, that's the program that collects data on Americans' communications, indeed had not yet prevented a terrorist attack. But he said there he thinks it's still a vital tool. Here's Morell.
It is absolutely true that the 215 program has not played a significant role in disrupting any terrorist attacks to this point. That is a different statement than saying the program is not important.
Siobhan Gorman, you said the president's not likely to hand this data over to a third party. Do you see him laying out any federal government step away from that information or the way it's been handled that's been so controversial since Snowden's revelations?
Well, I mean, I'd expect that he may be able to, he may lay out some more limitations, just sort of the NSA would use internally to restrict the extent of searches it can do. For example, you know, looking at how many links out from a particular source they can go in their analysis. But I also think that there's some expectation that the president will at least outline his thinking in terms of how he weighs the value of programs like this, whether or not he will reflect the type of analysis that Mr. Morell described, which is similar to what you hear from intelligence officials, you know, at NSA and elsewhere, which is that even if the program hasn't prevented a particular terrorist attack, it serves a purpose in terms of ruling out kinds of certain kinds of threats, certain kinds of plots, and is a factor in the analysis, as opposed to sort of the tipping point in any particular investigation.
Stephen, do you see a measure that the president could outline tomorrow which would then satisfy those national security officials who really want this and you know, American citizens who say, no, that's just straight up against the Constitution.
Well, there it is, and that's the problem, you know. And you know, you mentioned earlier, people have been tracking, you know, what you want to call the evolution, let's say, of the president's thinking from a senator to a candidate to the president, who's actually responsible for this. And you know, as someone pointed out, I saw someone quoted earlier, and I really agree with it. If there is another big incident, you know, it's 2 minutes before someone gets on CNN and says, you know, well, that's because we lifted this program or that program. And that may well not be the case there, but you know, there's a certain degree of caution. I spoke to one person myself in doing the story who is now the deputy CTO, chief technical officer of the U.S., and she's been involved in this. Her previous job was for Google. She was the chief privacy person for Google, and now I heard something different from her than when she was at Google. And that happens to you when you get in the government.
Let's go to Barry in Athens, Georgia. Barry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute.
Yeah.
And what I say has nothing to do with whether I think the NSA's programs are necessary, good, or whatever. What would happen, or what would have happened, if there was a terrorist attack, or there will be a terrorist attack, and the NSA, in fact, had either lifted these programs or hadn't used these programs, even though they had the capability to do it, and they had the capability to detect a terrorist attack? What would the public's response be? What would the media's response be? And your guest just said something about CNN on it.
Yep.
What would the public say? Would they have a totally different view of the of this transparency issue? Saying, you could have protected us, but you didn't.
It's a good question, but would you? Are you ready then to hand over some civil liberties, some constitutional protections for that?
I don't know what I'm willing to do right now.
Yeah. Barry, let us hold that question for just a minute. I'm really glad you raised it from Athens, Georgia. And let me get one more, maybe in a similar vein. Lee in Charleston, South Carolina. Lee, you're on.
Yes, in response to this gentleman's question, Churchill, back during World War II, did not disclose that a town was going to be bombed by the Germans in order not to alert the Germans that they had intercepted their transmissions. There's an infrastructure in place by the NSA. They are gathering data. They know the players. They know how they interact. And when that trigger happens, when someone contacts a particular person, that's when they'll know that there's going to be a problem.
But Lee, can we draw some meaningful parameters around that information gathering that let us have security and our constitutional rights?
I hear what you're saying. The problem that we have is that since the Vietnam War, there's been a disconnect because of the lifting of the draft, that the average person does not know how the military acts and what they're willing to do and what they're not willing to do. They understand the necessities of protecting the rights of the citizen, but they also have to protect the citizen. So in so doing, they have to collect data. The problem has been is that there's been an alarm thrown up because people have been disconnected from what the military does, and they're totally in the dark. And all of a sudden, when a fellow discloses information, all of a sudden it becomes an alarm.
Well, in the end, I mean, it's civilians. People don't stay in the military forever, most of them. Even those in, they retire. It's our civilian constitutional rights that the military is there to defend. But then there's the security issue at the same time. Siobhan, one of the things that's been raised here is getting the NSA further out of the military oversight, not having the military figure in charge of the NSA. Is the president likely to act on that front?
Nope. The White House actually put out, even before the review group officially issued its recommendations, there had actually been some reports about what the review group was going to recommend, including in our paper. And so the very next day, the White House put out the fact that they were not going to take the recommendation to split the what's known as Cyber Command from NSA, which if they were to have taken that recommendation, that would mean that they could put a civilian at the helm of NSA, which was also one of the review group's recommendations. But in saying that they were going to keep those two positions sort of co-located as one, that means that the head of NSA would still have to be a military commander in order to also head up Cyber Command.
Well, I'm reading here in National Journal, James Oliphant writes, the headline is, "If you want Obama to rein in the NSA, you're about to be disappointed." Says the president will embrace some surveillance reforms, but he's not about to scale back the national security state. Ken in Bangor, New York. Ken, you're on the air.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, I'm very concerned about the future of this country. I see strong parallels between what's going on in America today and the rise of Nazi Germany. And I was reading Naomi Wolf's book, End of America, where she outlines the closing down of a free society into a tyrannical state, and I'm very concerned that that's what's going on here. And I just don't believe that we should sacrifice the Constitution for the illusion of safety and security, because it's not going to make anybody safer. In fact, giving up our civil liberties and our freedoms and our privacy will actually make us more vulnerable to a state power.
What about our callers, Ken, who say, you know, the morning after a big attack, you might be singing a different tune? What do you say to them?
I say that everybody drops the ball once in a while, and if we have to take the hit once in a while because of in the interest of freedom, then we have to take a hit once in a while in order to preserve our freedoms and our civil liberties. Ultimately, it's up to us, each individual citizen, to ensure our safety, and the government is supposed to work for us.
Ken, I appreciate your call. I mean, it is so interesting that we would have known very little of this, very likely at all, if it hadn't been for Edward Snowden. One of the big pushes that people are expecting here, Siobhan, is a push to prevent future Edward Snowdens. It seems there's a lot of anticipation that there will be much more monitoring, much tougher security clearances, continuous monitoring of NSA analysts and employees. Do you expect that to be coming down the pike in the president's speech, Siobhan?
Well, I would expect that the president would address it, just because it was also an issue that was addressed by the review group in terms of tightening up the security clearance process. The review group recommended something pretty specific, which was to have a some sort of nonprofit entity handle the background checks for security clearances, because there's been a lot of criticism of that in the wake of the Snowden leaks. But I mean, NSA has already said that it's tightening its own security procedures. And one thing that we hear sort of periodically, at least from lawmakers, although it hasn't been a focal part of the discussion, is that NSA should have been doing those things already. And there are still a number of questions as to what was going on in terms of NSA management, that it didn't have its own systems secured.
And yet, I mean, you can understand why they'd want security there. Without the leaks, we wouldn't know what's going on or have a glimpse of it. Michael in Burlington, Vermont. Michael, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I have a comment. I got out of the NSA during the Vietnam War. I was in an Air Force affiliate. So my comment is that really, unless whistleblowers have a legal route to speak up, you're going to get things like Snowden's, which I think it would be pretty easy to say that it spiraled out of control. And that's happened because of things being totally bottled up. So basically, without an outlet, here's what happens. If you believe in what you're doing and think everything is great, you stay in. If you see problems, you get out. So what you end up with is an immense culture, very black, and it's full of people that are paranoid, obsessive, compulsive, possibly schizophrenic organizationally, because they say one thing publicly and do other things internally. And there's really no accountability at all, and no legislation from the top is going to fix anything in this organization. It's only going to come when somebody down in the ranks sees something that says, oh, my God, this is not okay.
So what would you like the president to say tomorrow? What plans would you like him to announce to the country, Michael? You've been inside.
Well, I would just like to see the more whistleblower protection, period. Nothing else is really going to matter. I mean, it's you're nibbling on the edges, and it makes it look like something is happening. But you've got an organization that's basically out of control, and always has been. I mean, I haven't seen anything changes from the little bits and pieces that I see in the news since I got out, that anything really has changed in the culture at all.
Michael, I appreciate your call. Our time grows short. Stephen Levy, that's very interesting. You know, give the whistleblower some way. It's really a plea for accountability. We're told that the president will talk about transparency and disclosure, but you wonder how much of that there will really be compared to what's going on. Are you optimistic that we're making progress in coming to terms with this as a country in this time frame, Stephen, or is this going to be a longer trail?
Well, it's good we're having the debate there. The fact is, if it weren't for Snowden, you know, we wouldn't be focusing on this. We wouldn't have learned all of the stuff which disturbed so many people there. So that's a start. Interestingly, when I was at the NSA, quizzing them about some of these issues there, I brought up the idea of what if, as a couple mentioned, some future administration, some future head of the NSA was more like J. Edgar Hoover or something like that, and all these controls that they say they have on the way they access information was lifted. And I was surprised to say that they defended their programming for whistleblowers. They said, oh, people would go to the inspector general and they would line up there like a line at Disneyland there. So I thought it was interesting in regard to what we've seen happen to the people who have whistleblown.
Well, Edward Snowden is not at Disneyland now, but the country knows a lot more than it did, and everybody waiting to see what the president has to say, what concrete proposals he has to announce. Stephen Levy with Wired Magazine. His big piece was how the NSA almost killed the Internet. Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Siobhan Gorman with The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, you're great. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.